coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Hello, thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio UK. I am Jamie Krieger, and this is Worth Doing Badly, our weekly survey of the Bible lessons for each Sunday of the church year, and how, through their cumulative message, these readings help us navigate this world year after year until the consummation of time. Today we begin a new church year, a new lectionary with a new selection of readings, this time from Series C according to the three-year series, which for the most part focuses on Luke's narrative of the Gospel of Jesus Christ. Today, we're also welcoming someone new to our show. David, would you like to do the honors?
Yes, absolutely. Ethan Stoppenhagen, a former student, has always been an interesting conversational partner. He's always been mature beyond his age, and it just seemed like a good idea to add another voice to these reflections of a significantly younger voice. Ethan, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Just a little bit about myself. I'm currently studying toward the parish ministry and am in my last year of studies for that, and look forward to joining the ranks of preachers here in about a year.
Welcome, Ethan. I look forward to our time together, and I'm sure our listeners do too. All right, this coming Sunday is the first in the season of Advent, which means coming. And the readings are from the Old Testament, Jeremiah 33, verses 14 through 16, and Psalm 25, the first 10 verses. From the New Testament, the epistle reading from the Apostle Paul's first letter to the Thessalonians, chapter 3, verses 9 to 13. And the gospel lesson from Luke 19, verse 28 through 40, which is commonly known as the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. Talk about coming. David, let's begin with Jesus, no better place to start, and where he answers the Pharisees saying, "I tell you, if these were silent, the very stones would cry out."
One of the funniest passages in the New Testament that Jesus made clear that if free human beings would not welcome into Jerusalem, then he would employ a box of rocks. Now, here in the States, when we're going to talk about someone being dumb, we would say something like they're as smart as a box of rocks, which isn't smart at all. So Jesus uses this imagery, but makes it clear in this case, as interesting as talking rocks would be, they were not needed or desired, because this is his salvation is the way of incarnation. And when we're getting ready to celebrate Christmas, celebrate the festival of the incarnation, this means we are celebrating a movement of the Word becoming flesh, and Jesus being that quintessential Word who becomes flesh, and his salvation then would ride the momentum of this incarnation. Everything that Christ would do from this time on would be to be incarnating the Word and making it flesh. And this is done by the Word working in human hearts and being fleshed out in the free participation of freed souls. That's because his glory is that the Word working in our hearts will bring forth praise from our lips. And so the text supplies us with some really, I think, strange examples of what it means to be freely participating in the momentum of the incarnation. The disciples participated by being part of a borderline illegal scheme to rustle a colt. And then Jesus says, if they're caught, they were to involve some unknown owner who would be told to ignore this heist because the Lord has a need that this man can satisfy. And this bit of craziness came before the fraught and frightful main event, where crowds freely chanted their praise of Jesus's peace and glory which the rash Romans would have heard. And here Luke records that the Jewish leaders rightly feared this chant because the Romans would have heard it as a cry for insurrection. And the chant itself called into question the glory of Rome, which was called the Pax Romanus, the peace of Rome. And they recognized if another leader was coming along and promising a different peace, well, Rome was not a town big enough for a rival peace. Rome was not big enough for Jesus's peace. Now, had Christ's invitation to be involved with this salvation been snubbed or banned or crushed by violence, then the first Sunday of Advent would be a celebration of chanting rocks. While it'd be curious to know how the Romans would actually have dealt with that insurrection. But on this day, the rocks were not needed because Christ had, in fact, broken through to the hearts of single individuals to take up their role in his salvation. Now, I should point out that if the rocks felt that they had missed out on the big stage, later Luke records that Jesus called himself the stone, which the builders rejected, who would be the cornerstone of a building made with living stones. So, if need be, the crocs, the stones would cry out, but in this case, it wasn't needed. In welcoming Jesus and the beginning of the movement towards the cross.
One thing I wonder about this text, though, you say that it's Christ breaking into individual hearts, but from the perspective of the Pharisees, like you mentioned, it seems very much to be a riot, that it's mostly groupthink. It's not necessarily these people who have calmly discerned faith. What do we make of that?
That's a great question, because when we realize that the mob all of a sudden disappears the moment that Jesus is threatened with crucifixion, there's something to that. And yet the address is to Christ working within the single individual's heart. Do you have an answer to your question, Ethan?
I think what you mentioned, the cross, I mean, there's a point at which the crowd turns, right?
That yes.
The crowd who's crying out Hosanna here today will in just a few short days be crying out crucify him.
They are not being criticized for being in that crowd. It's a curious point. It's a tension in the whole thing to keep an eye on what how this unfolds and how Luke eventually explains this. And when we come to that during Lent, you'll have to remember to bring this up again as to whether what we're seeing here is something which is good and should be praised or something which should be held in suspicion. But again, the point is the psalm makes it clear that God's glory is when a person will say, I lift up my heart, or I lift my heart. Now, Ethan, let me ask you, the part of the communion liturgy that says, the celebrant says, lift up your hearts, and we respond, we lift them up to the Lord. Do you think, what do you think people think is going on if they give that any thought?
In some ways, I think a lot of people would think it's this inward ascent. Like if we're lifting up our hearts, we're ascending to some heavenly realm to participate in some magnificent thing.
Why the heart? I mean, this always puzzles me because, you know, the center of conscience in for the Hebrew is the liver, and the center of rationality is the mind. The center of emotion is the gut or the stomach. What is this heart thing? Why is it the heart that we lift up?
The heart, I think, is for a lot of people today, that's the seat of love.
Okay.
And so if we're going to ascend in heart, we're going to be connecting with that which is the source of our love.
Okay, so this is the appeal. This is the glory that the Psalm speaks of then, that somehow the way that God will do his work is to convert the heart, not with power, not with threats, not with bargains, but with this changing the heart to love in a way that is supernatural. All right, so the Psalm says that the psalmist says that he would freely lift up his heart, and which is something a heartless rock cannot do. And so when we say lift up, we lift our hearts to the Lord, as we say in the communion liturgy, it's to say that our essential self, in other words, there's all sorts of things about us, things that we don't like, things that we regret, things that we wish we would have done better, but also things that we desire, that we are a mixed bag, each individual, and there is an essential self, so that to lift up your hearts is to say, this is who I truly am, or as you said, Ethan, this is what I truly love, or who I truly love. And the psalmist makes this a fervent prayer, that we lift our hearts so that God would make happen what is humanly impossible. And the impossible petition in this psalm longs for God to save us from shame. And God's method of saving us from shame is to instruct and inform the heart. So our essential self, this heart, is changed by God through this inner working, instructing or in restructuring or informing or forming the heart from within. And the psalmist prays that we are saved from shame because he recognizes how we are so vulnerable to treachery. We are so insecure that we are willing to trust people without having good evidence. And that is the essence of shame. Shame is to have trusted someone that proves disappointing or dishonest. And so the psalmist cries that God would not put us to shame because God can be trusted to inform and instruct us. And the interesting thing is that even in this world, the psalmist celebrates that with God instructing the heart, we are liberated from suspicion. And so rather than living by suspicion, we can live, the psalmist makes clear, by God's mercy and kindness, which will not put us to shame because they are eternal and forever. So this one liturgical move to say we lift up our hearts to the Lord is a declaration of liberty. That the way that God is working is inaugurating a brand new way of peace and glory, which the Romans could not establish through their treachery and tyranny. This psalm is a sense of saying there is a different way of living in this world, even as bad as the world can get, because God is at work within each of our individual's heart, which is addressing our essential self. Now, I know that doesn't answer, Ethan, the question of the crowd, which is a very good question, which means that it can't be easily answered. But at the same point, that regardless of that, there's always this kind of comfort that the Lord is at work in teaching the heart. Now, you just were on return from vicarage. Did you find teaching to be an enjoyable aspect of what you did on vicarage?
Yeah, it was something that overall I enjoyed, maybe even more than preaching, because in that teaching setting you have more of a face-to-face interaction, where you're not only handing over information, but you're also receiving from them their experiences and the ways that, even beyond what you as a teacher are teaching, how other things in life have taught them. So in some ways, the way God is teaching is not simply through his word and through the people who teach his word, but also in the way of in temptations and in tribulations, these things that actually would in some ways cause shame. God is in some ways taking the shame away from those.
So did you find, though, that people understood that with this teaching, as frustrating and as difficult as it is, that God's most important work of informing the essential self was going on?
Yeah, I don't know if it was always something they were aware of. In many ways, I think it's something that happens at the subconscious level. Even when we attempt to wrap our minds around it, there's something that shifts so that it's all of a sudden outside of our reach again.
It seems almost kind of silly to make the claim that God's most important work is happening through this instruction and this information. And yet, you know, if the psalm is to be believed, that is the case. The essential self is being addressed in a way that nothing else can do it. And yet, you know, those of us who have tried and failed miserably at teaching have to be reconverted over and over again, that this is the way that God prefers to do his works. And if need be, if it can't be done, then the box of rocks are waiting for their big time. All right, so moving on to Jeremiah, here is a frustrated teacher who thought that everything he said was just, he tended to doubt that he was accomplishing anything and that his words were just falling on deaf ears. And yet, in this passage, he gives Judah a name. And the name is, "The Lord is our righteousness." Now, if you read Jeremiah, you recognize that here is a prophet who was very adept at pointing out all the things that were wrong. But in the midst of that, in the midst of that shame, he comes through clearly and says that this is our essential self. This is what we truly desire, that the Lord be our righteousness, and that the Lord, as our righteousness, overcomes all that is wrong with us and with the world. That is the declaration. Of course, none of the empirical evidence reflected that. That was something that was true and worked its way into the individual heart. And at this particular time in Jeremiah's world, the kingdom of Judah was about to be decimated and destroyed. There was nothing in the external world that looked right. And that name also expresses an expectation that we should not be surprised when every worldly scheme of righting wrongs through the exercise of power ends in shame. And I'm just reminded when reading this of that Augustine's account of the fall of Rome in his City of God is a very long extended meditation on Rome's claim to glory collapsing in utter defeat and shame. And so rather than exercising external power, Jeremiah makes clear, it is God's glory to slowly and secretively instruct and inform the individual heart. And Ethan, I just don't ever think that it looks all that impressive. And I think it's by design that God does not want it to look impressive. It is rather something that works slowly. Now, let me just add to this. I am new to the appreciation that one of the ways that God works is by teaching us that time is not our enemy. This is why when we talk about Advent, we're talking about that one of the main tasks of the church is to maintain a very different calendar. Now, why is this? It's because With God as our righteousness, time is no longer our enemy. When God is our righteousness and not the world or not ourselves, then time measures and marks the progress to the fulfillment of God's promises. And though that fulfillment is true, says Jeremiah, even if everything else, every other promise has led to shame. So this is why three times in these few verses, Jeremiah states that the time is coming. The time is moving toward the fulfillment of God's promises. And that fulfillment is the antithesis of shame. I know that almost no one thinks that it is a significant act that the church remain faithful in keeping its calendar. And that's because almost no one believes that God is at work doing his most essential work in instructing and informing us, in which the claim is, the promise is, that that will change how each of us live in this world. And yet, even if things, according to Jeremiah, get that bad, it never changes the stubborn fact that the Lord is our righteousness. And in a sense, what faith is learning to recognize that it doesn't really matter how much unrightness there is in ourselves or in the world, so long as the Lord is our righteousness, then we will not be put to shame.
And that slowness of God's righteousness, it in many ways demands that calendar, or a cyclical calendar, because when it takes so long to see the fulfillment of that righteousness, you have to go back to the beginning and start it all over again and review and repeat. And that's one of the beauties of the church calendar and us starting again here with Advent, is that we're going back to, we're going to the beginning by starting at the end. And we're seeing how the two inform each other and play off of one another.
Again, I've just come to appreciate more and more the way that the Advent calendar makes a calendar this the center of attention. And there are all sorts of different Advent calendars now. And I just remember how the kids expected that with each passing day, there would be a piece of chocolate for them. And now, while that's kind of a crass materialistic payoff, those of us who get to work with these texts that rotate weekly recognize it's a kind of Advent calendar. When once you open up, there are all sorts of hidden treats and insights that happen. And as we've discussed, the problem is that it is so rich and so saturated and so dense that by the time you actually have to put this into a sermon, it's very frustrating to know what to put in and to cut out. And you know, maybe more than half the time you feel like it could have been done so much better than what you've actually accomplished. And yet we get the glory of, even as badly as we might have screwed up, another day is coming, another Sunday is coming. We get yet another chance to engage these texts. And I mean, I don't know if this is true of you, but the idea that somehow a calendar that moves forward by festivals and by readings just strikes me as so rich and enjoyable. And then you add the fact that throughout the ages, that church musicians have offered music and chants and the Psalms. It makes the idea of sustaining a calendar, even though very few people think it all that important, if it is important, then there are all sorts of resources to make it very rich. And I used to feel badly about the number of people who would come for Christmas services, and that was it. And now I'm rather impressed by that aspect. Christmas, that aspect of the church calendar, still has a lure and a draw to people that It's hard to explain. All right, so we go back. We finish now with 1 Thessalonians, in which Paul talks about his own work in terms of strengthening our hearts. So in this case, we're not lifting up hearts. Rather, the heart is the source of strength to live in the world. And Paul is effusive in expressing his enjoyment that he, in his part of God's instructing and informing transformation of the human heart. Paul says it's immeasurable, the joy that participating in God's work of changing the heart is for him. And Paul's love of the immeasurable is so much much needed medicine in our materialistic age. The biggest problem that is that people imagine that the measurable is the real. And consequently, if we're only looking at the material and the measurable, then we'll be blind to God's most glorious achievement is, as you pointed out, Ethan, the slow transformation that takes place over the long arc of time of the individual where it's slowly and secretively instructing and informing his word. And this is, I mean, God's patience allows for people to take time. I'm not allows for people. I just find it amazing how patient God has been in this slow instruction in my own life of being able to come to truths, sometimes difficult truths, slowly and have them work out in daily life. Now back to Paul's joy of having a role in God's instructing and informing. Paul was not filled with a lot of the resentment that you oftentimes hear of people whose ministry hasn't been going according to the way they think. Paul, even filled with hardship, expresses his gratitude and joy and the rejoicing in this role. And the role is that he is teaching others how to live in God's real presence. He is teaching others that no matter what the conditions in this world, if God is really present, then everything has been changed. And Paul so much loves this idea of real presence that was established in the incarnation, that he would not have at all been satisfied with people advocating distance learning. Paul actually thinks that the point of salvation is the joy of watching the word becoming flesh and watching that word working in people's hearts and becoming a part of their lives. And Paul wishing to be a part with those people who he is playing this role as teacher in their lives. So for Paul, faith is a source of joy and rejoicing because faith is participatory. Faith is something which we are involved in being part of this momentum of the incarnation. And it's immeasurable. It's an immeasurable truth that he ends with this thing that what is at work here, that no matter how badly things are in this world, no matter how threatened by shame we are, those who are in Christ are somehow blameless and holy. That is our true essential self. That is the heart that we lift up to the Lord, the heart that he has in Christ made blameless and holy. And if the heart is blameless and holy, as Paul will say elsewhere, then there is no charge. There is no shame. There is nothing that can be brought against the individual. God has, in fact, become our righteousness.
Thank you, David, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app, go to the App Store or Google Play, and get the one that is right for you for free. If you have any questions or comments about our program or any other programs on our schedule, write me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. David and I will be back next week at this same time. Stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.